is to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
It's a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. It appears to be our last podcast for 2011. That may change if the news changes things, but I'm planning to take a little bit of a break, and we will be back at you starting January 2nd. And today I want to welcome Sybelle Edmonds to the Peter B. Collins Show. She and I collaborate on the Boiling Frogs interview series, and today she joins us because she has been breaking news about the conflict in Syria and involvement of NATO forces in nearby Jordan. Sybelle, welcome to the program today.
Thank you, Peter.
And we're also joined by Sybelle and my favorite globetrotting international reporter, who is the correspondent for Asia Times Online, the website atimes.com. Pepe Escobar returns. Hello, Pepe.
Hi, everybody, live from Sukhoti Park. Great to be with you again.
Well, it's nice to have you in the United States and capturing some of the whiff of resistance from Americans there at Zuccotti Park.
Oh, yes, tell me about it. It's nowadays, it's a very sorry scene because there is this gun tower. It's 25 NYPD cars and sands and all that. The whole thing is walled. The park is a public park, but not really public, walled. But I've for the last 2 hours or so, I've been talking to still amazing people who are still coming to Zuccotti Park, and they are keeping the flame.
Yeah.
And it's one of the most important stories of 2011, if not the most important.
Well, I'm pleased to hear you say that because I think that it has been a very powerful movement in a way that is different for the United States and expression of political views and opposition to the government. And we have a limited amount of time with you today, Pepe, and I want to focus on the conflict in Syria. And you have quoted Sybelle in recent articles of yours, and she's been doing a fabulous job with the sources she has both in Turkey, Jordan, Syria, and here stateside to bring us a lot of important information which is not covered by the corporate media here in the United States. And I'd like to begin with a couple of brief quotes from the news reported by the Associated Press, which is giving us the official Washington spin on what's going on in Syria. And then I'd like to ask each of you to help us understand backstories and other things that we're blacked out on in the corporate media here in the United States. So the Associated Press story begins that as government troops advanced on a village in northwestern Syria, they say the terrified residents fled into a valley. There was an organized massacre. More than 100 people were killed, and it's described as one of the bloodiest days of the crackdown by President Bashar Assad in this nine-month uprising. And this has led to strong statements from the White House, which said it is deeply disturbed by Tuesday's attack. France referred to it as a murderous spiral. The Arab League reminded the Assad regime of its responsibilities to protect its civilians. And the UN reports that more than 5,000 people have died since this past March as Syria has sought to put down the uprising. Now, that's a quick sketch of what Americans are hearing and being told about what's going on in Syria. But Pepe, there is much more. Let me let you begin, and you and Sibel can dialogue about the reports that you have been publishing that add a lot to the story, much more than in the corporate media.
Absolutely. What he's basically saying it's like 20% of the original NATO plan for what's going to happen in Syria next. They're trying to sell world public opinion and American public opinion the idea that there's going to be a massacre, probably in Homs in Syria. I've been talking to some people in Homs, in fact, exchanging emails with them, and they're saying, look, there's nothing like this. There are skirmishes. We simply cannot trust the Free Syrian Army. That's what they're saying over there. We know they are real with opportunists. They are defectors. But they are some foreign mercenaries that they cannot place exactly if they are from Qatar or the Emirates. But they are there helping the Free Syrian Army. They are crossing the border from Lebanon to Syria. They're crossing the border from Jordan to Syria as well. So this is part of NATO's plan. So if you sell the UN... world public opinion and American public opinion, the idea there is going to be a massacre, just like that massacre that would be happening in Libya 8 months ago, then you can have a UN resolution or you can have an intervention. There won't be a UN resolution because Russia and China are very close with that. This is their extreme red line, Syria. They are already coordinating at the UN. They coordinated in a meeting in St. Petersburg last month of their deputy foreign ministers. The Brazilians and the Indians are, you know, side by side with the Russians and the Chinese on this one. And what we have in terms of NATO strategy is something that Sibel's website broke as well. Also, we at Asia Times, we did a story about that. That famous NATO command and control center in Hatay province in southern Turkey, which is across the border. It's in Iskenderun, which is very close from the Syrian border. And it's a stone's throw from Aleppo, in fact. I would say that it's probably 2 hours away from Aleppo. They want to more or less install a civil war atmosphere in northern Syria. This is the target of this NATO command and control center. And the story that Sibel broke about these moves from America, probably American troops from Iraq, going to Kuwait, but going to the Jordanian-Syrian border as well, they're going to set up another command and control center near Deraa. Deraa is very, very close to the Syrian border as well. So it's a matter of, what, half an hour probably from the Syrian border to Deraa. So it's a sort of pincer movement. This is what NATO has been doing. This is the extremely hidden agenda, let's put it this way. A pincer movement, civil war in northern Syria, spreading through these small towns in the countryside, but with the main target, Aleppo, 2.5 million inhabitants, the most important city in Syria, and a pincer movement from the south as well, in a Syrian-Jordanian border, in southern Syria, around Deraa, which is a very isolated place, it's a very poor place, very disgruntled, with a very important contingent of hardcore Islamists as well, and throw the dice and see what happens, because it's not going to be through the UN, it's not going to be through a Security Council resolution. They're trying to entice a response from the Syrian army. And this prophesized attack or massacre is actually going to happen. If the Syrians fall for this, it's going to be a major trap. For the moment, it's still unknown.
So, Sibel, add, if you would, for our listeners who may not have read the important posts that you've published at BoilingFrogsPost.com about the gathering of NATO forces and the reports you have of people who don't speak Arabic, soldiers or other fighters who appear to be gathering on the Jordanian-Syrian border at this time.
Right, Peter. And Pepe got all the points right. Absolutely. What I got, and this was at the end of October from my sources, and these are several independent sources from military sources in Turkey and also U.S. military sources, that we started establishing this base and working, and this is very close. close to Incirlik base. This is a U.S. base in Turkey, working with the army defectors. And at the time, they had less than a dozen of people. And one of them who has been leading and working together with U.S. and NATO forces there is this guy. He's Colonel Riyad al-Assad. And he's the one, together with U.S. and NATO forces, coordinating the communication with the people in Syria. And this includes mainly targets Assad's military people who are currently with military. So they've been enticing people to leave, to defect, to come to Turkey, and they have been expanding this rebel-based army in Turkey where they are working together with U.S. and NATO forces. Now, the second story, as Pepe just told you, this came from three, four sources that we've had, and in fact, they have cordoned off the area because right now, even journalists, Middle Eastern journalists, can't go to that area in Jordan near the Syrian border, because it has been cordoned off. So nobody can go and see what's going on. But they have reported seeing foreign forces, foreign troops there. In fact, they are saying they are light-skinned. They seem to be Europeans or Americans. But we are still waiting to receive more confirmation on that. But interestingly, I have been very disappointed with some of the even, well-known Middle Eastern reporting agency. When they went to home, Pepe, they were trying to show how the town has been protesting against Assad and they have shut down the stores there. Well, they went and filmed the city, the downtown area, at 5 o'clock in the morning when all the stores are closed anyway. So this is part of this psychological warfare, trying to line up the Western opinion when, in fact, the decision was made, God knows, maybe a year ago, and the preparation began last May. You're looking at 7 months ago. Now they are taking care of the publicity and the psychological warfare by trying to basically create this public support for the, at least the Western part of the world. And I want to mention one other thing, and that is the if you look at the release by the White House, basically they are saying, we don't care what Assad does. We don't believe him. No matter what, we want him gone. If you really go and read in between the lines, they have made up their minds. No matter what, they are going to do this. And as far as the Arab League is concerned, that is pretty comical. Look at the member nations. I mean, you're looking at Bahrain. You are looking at a dictator regime who's been shooting, you know, people and jailing and torturing people on a daily basis. Today, I read the news with Morocco and the police there beating up the protesters. So you're looking at these nations to go that and report on Syria. That, in a way, is the most comical aspect of all this, if it weren't this serious.
Now, Pepe, tell us your thoughts about the information that we're being fed here in the United States. How much of it is spin and how much of it is pure disinformation? In fact, is there a resistance that's developed from defectors of the Syrian army who are taking on Assad, or is that fiction that is being produced, you know, for consumption outside of Syria in order to support NATO's clear effort to take out the Assad government?
Absolutely, Peter. It's a mix of disinformation and spin. According to our best sources in Syria, what's going on, really going on, is that the bourgeoisie in Aleppo and Damascus, the upper middle class, the trading classes, the people who have authorizations from the regime to trade in any currency they want, especially with Russia, with China, for instance. A lot of people in the U.S. probably don't know that there is already a kind of new Silk Road between Damascus and Shanghai, Beijing, let's put it this way. These are Syrian traders that buy stuff in China and resell in Syria, and Chinese traders who see an opportunity in a developing market in Syria, and they do business with Syrian traders, and some of them even relocate to live in Syria as well. So the trade connection, the commercial connections between China and Syria are very, very strong. With Russia, there are also military connections and weapons connections. Russia sells a lot of weapons to Syria, plus they have landing rights or docking rights at this naval base in Tartus in the Eastern Mediterranean. That's where the Russian Black Sea Fleet goes every year. That's where they're going right now as we speak, right? The aircraft carrier Mario Kuznetsov is going to be in Tartus probably in 2 weeks' time. So what's going on is that the upper classes and the regime-aligned classes in Egypt, they haven't revolted because they think that the Assad regime is strong enough to ride this wave of protest. So if you talk to, let's say, a trader, a Bazaari trader in Damascus, for instance, he's going to say, look, the regime is stable. Of course we know it's a police state, but we can trade with the rest of the world. You know, they don't extract anything else from us. We have some opportunities. The country is relatively, it is stable, and it's peaceful apart from these protests. And this is something from those, you know, hicks in the countryside. That's how they would define people in homes, for instance, or in Deira, near the Jordanian border. When you look at the geography, when you look at the composition of most of the people who are part of the protest, it's true. The protest started at the margins of the major cities and towns in Syria. There is, of course, a Google generation component as well. This is something that the last time I was in Syria, these guys told me, look, it's going to take years. We would like to have some kind of protest like the Green Movement in Iran, which for them is a reference, in fact. Mm-hmm. But they're saying, look, this is going to take years. In fact, it didn't take so long. But they are a minority. These are the people who, they are young, connected, well-educated, and unemployed in Syria, just like their counterpart in Bahrain, for instance, or in Egypt, or in Tunisia. But they don't have enough numbers, and they have no political organization to mount a large-scale protest. So what we're seeing already is that what has started, in fact, there were some protests in Aleppo, in suburbs of Aleppo or suburbs of Damascus, far away from the city center, all right? But they were smashed. And now the opportunists, just like in India, the defectors, the opportunists, they are hijacking the protest and going against the government. And the fact that the so-called Free Syrian Army is being armed by Qataris, by Emiratis, by Saudis, you know, by foreign powers, basically, and more or less composed with a few defectors from the regime, it's an army of mercenaries, basically, just like the Free Libyan Army, the Libyans that were formerly known as rebels, you mm-hmm. know. And you know what the recipe is going to be. It's what we're witnessing in Libya today, which is already a failed country post so-called liberation.
Now Pepe, let me jump in to credit you on our programs for predicting in Libya that Khalifa Haftar would surface as a major figure. He is now the leader of the Libyan army, and you were the one who reported to us that he had lived near the CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia for more than 20 years, was part of a coup effort against Gaddafi in the 1990s, and he's been installed. The new prime minister, who appeared from virtually nowhere, has ties to the petroleum industry around the globe, served as a consultant to the Emirates and also to a number of American corporate interests. So with that as backdrop, what do you see as the U.S.-NATO goal in Syria? Who do they hope to install there if they are successful in pushing Assad out or using proxies to achieve that?
Well, the Americans already have a candidate, and he was on the Wall Street Journal like two weeks ago, I think. He gave an extensive interview to the Wall Street Journal, Barhoum Ghalian. He's a Paris exile. He's been living in Paris for a long time. I learned about him in one of my visits to the Syrian embassy in Paris 3 or 4 years ago. And a lot of people told me about Ghalian, that he was a an important period exile, that if anything happened in the future, he would be a prime candidate. And here it is. And he has been already introduced to American audiences. In his interview, he made all the right noises to the right people in Washington, and I would say to the extreme right people in Washington, saying, no, we're going to cut off our relationship with Iran. We're going to cut off the relationship with Hezbollah and Hamas as well. Syria is going to align with the Western camp, progressive, democratic, all that the usual blah, blah, blah. So this would be the candidate. It's the Syrian Transitional Council, Syrian National Council, as they call them themselves. They are based in Istanbul and in Paris. Galium, basically in Paris, but a lot of people in Istanbul as well. That's where they met the last time. So it's the same, exact same Libyan model. The only difference is, how NATO is going to pull that off without a UN security resolution? This is what we're working on as we speak.
Now, you wrote in your article, NATO Dreams of Civil War in Syria, that people can read at atimes.com, Asia Times Online. You report that your sense is, from your sources, that U.S. and NATO hope that Turkey will essentially be the lead dog on this sled. Explain,
right.
And maybe in reference to Libya, where the U.S. Purportedly led from behind, are we trying to lead from behind and have Turkey be at the front lines?
And in fact, Peter, I would like to pose this question to Sibel, in fact, because this is something that a lot of us have been scratching our heads for the past months or 2 months. In fact, what is Turkey's real game vis-a-vis Syria? Imagine a post-Ottoman Turkey with an official foreign policy, which is called a zero problems with our neighbors, devised by Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoglu, which is a very competent scholar and a very decent man. You know, he's not corrupt or anything. On the contrary,
absolutely.
And suddenly, they create a problem with their key neighbor in the south, harboring a NATO command and control center in their southernmost province. Erdogan has been saying out loud that Assad must go. Davutoglu himself, in one of his latest public appearances, he was practically saying the same thing.
I wrote
but then there was
right.
a lull. These past few days, there has been a lull. They have not been saying anything. Is that if they are concentrating on the shadow war itself, and a major control and command center for the shadow war is actually inside Turkey. So what is Turkey planning to achieve? Are they planning to get closer to NATO and prove to NATO that they are an important forward operational base? And by doing so, they can also convince the recalcitrants inside the European Union that they can be a formidable actor by joining the European Union as well.
Excellent point, Pepe. And I wrote a piece on this.
Yes.
In fact, what I did was I showed that until last year, all the joint press conferences between Assad and Gül or with Assad and Erdogan, and we are talking about increasing trade, and Erdogan and Gül saying that basically because of sharing the religion and culture and heritage, they are brother states. I mean, you're looking at all this glorious, intimate, wonderful relationship that all of a sudden, bam, takes this 180-degree turn. There are several reasons, and you mentioned two of them. One is, of course, the EU point and the promises that are being given behind the scenes. Of course, the usual pressure by U.S., NATO, and the financial bribery. But the biggest reason, Pepe, is U.S. is going to fulfill their promise to Turkey on northern Iraq. You see, before the war started in 2000, towards the end of 2001, while they were planning the war on Iraq, Turkey wanted to be involved, okay? And the reason Turkey
right.
didn't let Americans use their base for attack was not because they cared about the Iraqis and they didn't agree with the war. Turkey had one condition. The condition was, you let us take care of the Kurds in our share of managing and have certain level of control over the oil field in northern Iraq. And the promise that U.S. NATO gave to Turkey was, not until we pull out, not until we are finished, you are not going to get involved, but after that, we'll give you the green light. Now, here is what I predict. Based on the past, I would say this is this exchange. In exchange for rights to go in there and massacre the Kurds in northern Iraq, because the problems they've been wanting to do this for years, and this is Turkey, and U.S. is going to give them the green light. Look, they gave them all these drones that they finished using in Iraq. They gave them to Turkey, and Turkey has been using it in northern Iraq on a daily basis. So I would say between the financial incentive, U.S. NATO pressure, the promise on EU front, the biggest reason is what Turkey is going to get out of this in return in terms of having free hands with the Kurds in northern Iraq, and that's my sense.
Wow, but this is completely crazy.
So it is.
It means, in essence, that Turkey will be at war with Iraq, because it's still Iraqi Kurdistan, it's part of Iraq.
Oh, yeah, they got to fight terrorism.
And on top of it, the Turks probably, they would harboring the illusion that they could solve a part of the Kurdish problem as well if they created a sort of buffer zone for Kurds inside Syrian territory as well.
Yeah.
And let me ask a question here as somebody who knows the least about this but has some instincts here. If Turkey wages war on the Kurds in northern Iraq, with more than the kind of incursions of troops and fighters that have occurred with U.S. approval in the past, we don't have much of an army left in Baghdad, either ours or theirs. They have no air force to speak of. They're starting to build one. And if Turkey invades Iraq to cleanse the Kurds...
Just northern part, yes.
Yes, then wouldn't Baghdad turn to Iran and say, help us repel the Kurds?
No.
All right.
They won't, because...
Well, the thing is, what I would venture, in case this is a strong possibility, in case it happens, obviously Turkey and Iran would have to more or less coordinate their policies, because both have a Kurdish problem.
Yeah.
The PKK may be a much bigger problem for Turkey than the PJK is for Iran. But still, both have a Kurdish problem.
Yes.
So if that happens, obviously they'll coordinate. Okay, we both tackle the Kurds, and we try to push them off to northern Syria. Which, can you imagine that we're actually talking about this possibility? And I'm sure this is what they're discussing right now.
They are, and that's a very, very good point, Pepe. Most people are not aware that one thing that provides this bond between Iran and Turkey is the mutual, what they call the mutual Kurdish problem. And as you know, with the Western countries, as it was during the British Empire, they love sectarian wars. They love to see this divide in a country. And even from central Iraqi government, the Kurds, as usual, they're not going to have any support or backing. So basically, they're going to sit and they're going to let it happen. And this is the central government. And as far as Syria is concerned, this is just like Africa, okay, Peter? Because to get a Muslim country going after Assad based on Assad's atrocities, as it's identical to every single other dictators right now who are ruling in the Middle East, they will stay face the Western countries. It's one thing for Muslims going after another Muslim, then let's say the Western Christian, / crusaders going there. Same thing with Africa. When you get African carrying out your dirty operations, okay, then you have black African going after Africans, it's a totally different image, issue, publicity than when you have a bunch of white guys going there, with U.S. armed forces, whether it's the Somalian front confrontation or if it's in Nigeria. So this is another, what they consider, the Westerners, the United States, a brilliant, safe space kind of a situation. Let the Gulf states, let Turkey, let Jordan get all the stuff while they are doing the stuff from behind. And that is that's another PR scheme, basically, that they have set up.
Pepe's blacked out audio-wise by a siren there. We've still got you, Pepe. We'll wait till the siren passes.
Okay. All right.
So, Pepe, we're clear on you now. What would you like to add to Sabel's comments there and about the, you know, the various calculations if Syria falls and if Turkey cracks down on the Kurds in northern Iraq? I want to follow up on your point about the push to force the Kurds across the border into Syria. It's not that far from Iraqi Kurdistan to the Syrian border. And do you see this as a kind of effort to transfer the Kurds away from Turkey and Iran and try to park them as refugees in a destabilized Syria?
Well, talk about the ultimate remix of creative destruction, right, if that ever happens. I don't, first of all, I don't think it's going to happen because there are too many interests involved. There are too many unpredictables. Even the Americans, though, they cannot calculate the possible repercussions. The Turks themselves, if the Kurds decide to mount a really hardcore counter-strike inside Anatolia, this thing can, you know, unravel in totally unpredictable ways. Going a little beyond of what we're talking now, I think 2012 is going to be the year of creative destruction all over. Not only in the area we're talking about, in Northern Africa as well, in Egypt, because Egypt now is completely destabilized with the military dictatorship in place, with the Obama administration interventions in Central Africa, with the Obama administration's program, which has a Third Reich overtone of America's Pacific century, the counter push from both Russia and China, and they are now coordinating that very, very strongly inside the BRICS and inside the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, inside the UN. So now, more or less, we have more or less the chessboard is spelling out something like this. Forget about this 10-year interregnum of war against terror, which, you know, just looking at the World Trade Center half an hour ago, I was just thinking about that. This was a detail in history. The real thing is the superpower war. And the superpower war is the U.S. against the strategic competitors, Russia and China. So this is going to take place all over the world, especially in the Middle East, in Northern Africa, inside Africa, but also in the South China Sea, in Central Asia. We're going to have these eruptions, like Syria, for instance. If Syria falls, the repercussions for not only for Russia and China, which have a strong interest with them, but for the U.S. and the strategic American interests in the Middle East are completely unforeseen. But it seems like the American establishment is betting on creative destruction now, much more than during neocon times 10 years ago, which is crazy now, but history sometimes goes through very devious ways and comes back to the same point. I think we're coming back to 10 years ago before 9/11, when the Washington establishment was looking, pointing for a fight with strategic competitors. They couldn't tackle China. They said, okay, let's try to fight a more convenient enemy, which became Islam, basically. So now it's back to the big boys fighting it out. And 2012, I think, is the ground zero for creative destruction a long, long time to come.
Pepe, one angle that we need to cover and haven't so far is the parallel or merged interests of the U.S. and Israel and the current confrontation with Iran. And when we look at the psychological operations that have been used, including the Arbabsiar scam, that was floated out in July of this year from Washington. And for people who weren't paying attention, that's this cockamamie scheme where a loser from Texas, who's an Iranian-American used car dealer, was going to make a deal with a guy who he thought was a representative of a Mexican drug cartel, turned out to be a DEA paid informant. And we are told that our Bob Sear had 250,000 wire transfers sent to the United States from Iran, which is the dumbest thing that any kind of a spy or even a common drug trader or money launderer would never do. And now that case is played as fact. This guy hasn't had a court appearance that we know of, but the media has convicted him. And now that scandal is taken as fact and a reason why the U.S. needs to ratchet up tensions with Iran. And it cannot be lost on Washington that Syria is an important component in the regional issues and in Israel's interests.
Absolutely. So we come back to pre-2001 times, and in fact 2001-2002 itself, the famous real men go to Tehran gambit. And for real men to go to Tehran, they would first conquer Iraq, they would move to Hezbollah in Lebanon and to Syria, and finally get to Iran. Once again, striking Syria is a way to get to Tehran. So there are two shadow wars going on. There's the shadow war in Syria that we have been discussed, and the shadow war in Iran, which has been going on for years now, and it accelerated especially in 2011. So expect many more false flag operations, black ops, spy ops, more drones over Iran, because this one that they captured was just one among many, flying over across the border from Afghanistan. The Americans have a base in Afghanistan, which is very close to the Syrian border. If they have drones in that base, which we think they do, it's very easy to overfly to eastern Iran, to the area that they captured this drone, which is not far from Mashhad. Mashhad is a very important city in eastern Iran. It's about four hours by taxi from the Afghan border. Anyway, so more shadow war in Syria, and much more shadow war inside Iran. The thing is, in Iran, this is a crucial year. There are going to be parliamentary elections in 2011, and a prelude for the next presidential election. And there is a power play inside Iran that is crucial for them. It's between Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei and the Ahmadinejad faction. And the IRGC, the guys who control the whole military, they control the civilian nuclear program as well. They control the missiles. They control everything that is weaponized in Iran. They are side with the Supreme Leader, and they are actually in favor of a confrontation against the Americans. So if we have a confrontational mood from Washington mixed with a confrontational mood in Tehran, we can expect fireworks. I wouldn't say sooner, that means 2011, but certainly after the American presidential election in November 2012. So that's why 2012 is a very important year, because it's going to be shadow war year all over the place, in the Middle East, in Central Asia, in Southeast Asia, in that confluence of Syria, Turkey, Iran. And, you know, when you look at the future, you cannot be too optimistic. Of course, no nihilism involved, but I would say a lot of pessimism.
Sabel, I'll ask you to comment on some of these things in a moment, but I have one more question for Pepe, and that is, what do you see evolving in Egypt and in the government in Cairo? Will the U.S. and Israel be able to limit the public protest that continues to this day? And will a friendly regime with the military on top be ruling Egypt, say, 1 year from now?
Exactly. When you look at Egypt 1 year from now, as you said, we have to be pessimistic, because the most probable outcome is going to be a Muslim Brotherhood majority government supported by the Salafis with, let's say, 60-65% of the votes and presence in parliament, supported by the military, because obviously they already made the deal. This is obvious, absolutely obvious. And the biggest losers will be exactly the secular, young, connected Google generation that was, you know, the heart and soul of Tahrir Square. which we cannot forget. It was the movement that sparked the indignados in Spain and later Occupy Wall Street and later Occupy the World. It started, it started with that guy burning himself, a la monks in Vietnam in 62, 63, Bouazizi in Tunisia. But it actually started in Tahrir Square 1 month later. So, you know, the prospects until the elections in Egypt are horrible. And most important thing, the military in Egypt, they won't abdicate from power because they control 40% of the Egyptian economy. These are the basic facts. They're being supported by the House of Saud, the international capital of counter-revolution. Hmm. They had already given $4 billion to the Egyptians, and they will give more. And the military in Egypt are closely allied with the House of Saud. The Muslim Brotherhood is basically an extension of the House of Saud, even if they have at least five different factions. But the most powerful factions, they are basically, you know, very well connected with the Ahabis. There's no difference. Plus the Salafi. So the perspective, from the point of view of a young revolutionary internationally connected in Egypt, are terrible. And even some of these guys have been telling me the same thing, some of these young Egyptian bloggers. And most important thing, this means that if there is this kind of power arrangement, this new government, this new setup, won't question what I would say 90% of the Egyptian population wants to question, which is the Camp David Accords. They want at least this to be renegotiated. So as long as the Egyptian military and the Muslim Brotherhood promise to the U.S. and obviously to the Israelis, look, we won't touch Camp David, it's okay. They can do anything they want, and bye-bye, the Tahrir Square spirit.
Well, Pepe, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for sharing your intel with us. And it is going to be an exciting year in 2012. And we hope to talk with you several times over the course of next year. Sibel, I wanted to turn to you and ask your thoughts about what I asked Pepe a few minutes ago about the interests of the U.S. and Israel, the way they've ratcheted up tensions with Iran, and how does this proxy battle in Syria play into the U.S.-Israeli interests?
Well, that's a very good question, because Iran basically is the last standing one out there as for the Washington, NATO, West Great Plan, as far as their plan goes. Now, with Iran, it's a totally different story. I think what we will see in terms of real operation, in terms of the overt operations on Iran, I believe we won't see that until next year after the election.
Mm-hmm.
That's my prediction. Again, it's based on what I know about the culture, about the differences, and therefore the kind of a modus operandi that they would have to adopt to work on Iran. Because what works in Syria, what works in Egypt, and what works with Turkey is not the same as what would work with Iran. First of all, they are very smart. They know how to detect and preempt internal provocation and operations inside the borders within Iran. And they have an excellent intelligence agency. I mean, this is one of those things that you don't hear people really talk about, but they do have a well-developed, well-functioning, very successful so far intelligence gathering method in there, and they know how to detect and expel foreign influences. I mean, you just take a look at all the embarrassing incidents for the U.S. I mean, all the people that they are catching, and they're saying, well, you know, we know who you are and who you work for. Now get out of here, after mm-hmm. they detain them temporarily. And they don't do it in a barbaric way either, because as you'll see, they have not harmed anyone. They are very good in not providing the excuse, you know, the excuse that the West is badly looking for. They have a much stronger support from China and Russia than any of these countries, even though Russia has expressed, you know, support for Syria and kind of cautionary statements in terms of trying to get U.S. and the NATO to back off, mm-hmm. they feel much stronger about Iran, because Iran is a different story. And with the Caspian Sea and right across the border, where you have the Azerbaijan across from the Caspian Sea, you are looking at a total different dynamics. I think we are going to try. The United States is going to try. We just saw a tiny bit of that with that Iran's Twitter revolution.
Right.
It didn't work. Mm-hmm. You see, and Iranians tend to unite really strongly, even though they are fragmented inside. When the choice comes between foreign occupation, the foreign imperialist agenda, let's mm-hmm. say United States, versus the government that, let's say, they're not crazy about or they hate. So when the time and the push comes, they actually support even those who are anti-Iranian regime.
Right.
They switch and they support the regime because they hate Western imperialism far more than they hate the current regime there.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have the opportunists. Now that's a different story. And we have had all these new developments with the Mujahideen Khalq, and that's the how U.S. is referring to them as MEK.
Right.
Now, Iraq wants them out. Now, United States convinced them to keep MEK, but have them switch location from one section of Iraq to another, because Iraq also wants to establish a decent relationship with Iran, and everybody knows what MEK has been doing there. So you have that faction that, and it's still considered as a terrorist organization by the United States, that mm-hmm. is receiving support, and they are basically trying to do what this army rebel forces for Syria, they are doing in Turkey. They are doing it in Iraq, but they have so far zero success, no success whatsoever, no influence. Here in the United States, you still have Shah's son, who lives only a few miles from where I live here,
mm-hmm.
in Maryland, Potomac area, and they have their own lobby, but they have been pushing for now 3 decades, trying to get support, because they keep trying to sell the ideas that we have enough people on the ground in Iran that we can bring about revolution, and we need your support. He's still dreaming of becoming a Shah. He still sees himself as a prince, and I can tell you this much, that group, and that is the in-exile prince, they have zero support, that group in Iran.
Well, just a quick aside, it was about 3 years ago, I dined at a restaurant in Georgetown, and the young Pahlavi and a group of retainers were having dinner a couple of tables away.
Right. I mean, Reza Pahlavi, he's very, very, he's still dreaming. You know, he grabs his latte and he dreams of the days of going and taking back his palace. They had golden commodes there and golden bathrooms. Believe me, he is still living with that dream, but that will always remain a dream.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Iranians have been anti-kingdom, anti-monarchy for nearly a century. They've been fighting that, so they don't have any chance. But it will be very interesting to watch a development with MEK, because right now it puts Iraq in a difficult position. Iranians are very well aware of what's going on. And so keep a close eye on MEK in Iraq and the latest developments there. And as far as other neighbors are concerned, you know, they really have to adopt a different modus operandi. And they are, of course, going to wait for an excuse being given to them by Iran. Again, Iran has been very smart. They have played it very smart, and they haven't provided that excuse. So it's going to be a different game. The scenario, as Pepe said, yes, it has become a cliche almost. That same Libya scenario for, you know, Egypt and Libya and then Syria, which is going to be a little bit of escalation of what we saw in Egypt. But you will be looking at a totally different scenario that has to be written originally, authentically, only for Iran. That same game plan won't work there. And it will be interesting to see what will come out of Syria. But my guess is their days are numbered. Because the White House has made it clear, they don't care. Even if Assad were to become one of the best leaders ever Syria had and be a pro-HR, human rights, they are going to see him, you know, gone.
Mm-hmm.
They are not going to accept anything. And this is a cosmetic last chance, which is totally cosmetic, to send these clowns from the Arab League, the dictators, to go and evaluate the other dictators' deeds.
And
I
Sibel,
was just telling a reporter with Russia Today, I said, with Bush, we had all those awful neocons. Now with Obama, we have neocon and liberals on steroid and cocaine. That's what we have.
Well, the humanitarian hawks will have a problem on their hands in applying the interventionist approach of Libya if they try it in Syria. And it certainly won't work in many other areas where we would turn a blind eye to a crackdown, say, on the Kurds, because of other deals that we have. And, Sibel, I want to recommend to our listeners, and maybe I should have mentioned this earlier, but as you're listening to today's podcast, I encourage you to go to your computer or pull out an actual atlas and look at the geography here. Because for many Americans, this is a part of the world that is not top of mind. And when you see the borders that are shared by these different countries, you see the Caspian Basin, which is rich in natural gas and to some extent crude oil, and you can start to get a much better handle on the interconnections between the resources, the populations, and how they break down along ethnic and religious lines, and also the various types of dictatorships. And, Sibel, I wanted to come back to what you and Pepe had been talking about. If Turkey does get the green light from U.S. and NATO to take care of its so-called Kurdish problem, that would be a kind of ethnic cleansing and a way to route them from southern Turkey and northern Iraq. And, you know, the civil war in Iraq is already starting. We've seen the Maliki government crack down on a Sunni leader who says that he's not guilty of the corruption charges that they have leveled. But now that the U.S. has more or less left, we know there are about 15,000 troops there, the U.S. is at least trying to dial back its frontline presence. And, you know, there are many different ways this could play out, but a Turkish invasion of northern Iraq, coupled with a Sunni Shiite civil war centered south of the Kurdish zone, could leave Iraq as a very unstable battleground and an area of mischief for neighbors, particularly Iran.
And that's inevitable, and that has, I believe, that has been already taken into account and has been calculated. And you have to look at Iraq and see the geography before the maps were drawn to the point what it is today. And what we are going to see, I believe, we are going to see a shift in the borders and even the countries we know. I mean, yes, we had it after the fall of the Soviet Union. We had it with Yugoslavia and Bulgaristan. But what we will be seeing here, it will be a different version of what we saw with the fall of the Soviet Union. Because also, as you said, in Iraq, you have the Shia element, and they're mainly in the south. Then you have the central Sunni government. Then you have northern Iraq, which is, again, resource-rich with the Kurds. And don't be surprised, and I'm not saying it's going to happen immediately, to see these countries to be, you know, sliced and go back into a different version of what they were before the borders were drawn artificially. And that is, you may have three different Iraqs. That's possible.
Mm-hmm.
And these are, again, these are the things that the government, and when I say the government, the shadow government, the powers behind the scenes, they are very well aware of, and they are really taking into consideration. And for Turkey, I mean, they see themselves as a major influence, again, in Central Asia, because they call them Turkic republics. They speak Turkic languages. They share the same heritage as Turkey. They are Muslims. They see themselves as highly influential there. Their strategic positions, and for years and years, since the end of the Ottoman Empire, since Ataturk, they've been planning and they've been dreaming of the resources, the oil wells there in northern Iraq. And they want two things. They want, of course, free hand in pursuing the Kurds. And as I said, these latest deals with the drones and what they have been doing, they are already taking excursions into northern Iraq. They are not at all observing the sovereignty. But it's not only the Kurds, but it's also they're having certain level of control over the northern Iraq oils, because, as you know, Turkey doesn't have any oil. I mean, they are strategically important, geopolitically important because of the pipelines and their locations, but as far as resources are concerned, they have been after those oil wells in northern Iraq, in Kirkuk.
Mm-hmm. Right. Sibel, today, as we're speaking, it's December 22nd, and at boilingfrogspost.com, you have a citation from the Chinese news service Xinhua, Dateline Amman, Jordan. And it is the announcement, which I have yet to see in the American media, that the United States has promised $660 million U.S. dollars to the Jordanian government for economic and military assistance in the coming year, 2012, and that the total from 2007 to the present is about $2.4 billion. Now, that represents a major portion of the Jordanian economy. Yeah. Is Jordan a pure client state of the United States at this point? And are the moves that you have described of troops that appear to be aligned with the U.S. and NATO operating near the Jordanian and Syrian border, is this all part of one piece?
Yes, it is. And again, after we broke the story at Boiling Frogs Post, that some of these international news organizations, they went to the Jordanian government, and the Jordanian government and the king's spokesperson vehemently denied, saying, we would never, ever let the foreign troops use our land and our country as an assault base for assault, and, you know, on Syria. Well, even that was worded carefully, assault, because right now what they are doing, they are putting the communication centers right now at the stage of logistics. It hasn't gotten to assault, but now you just mark my word, Peter, they have now this so-called Arab League, and Jordan is part of them. They're going into Syria by knowing exactly what they're going to say afterwards, whether it's 2 days from now, whether it's going to come out tonight, basically saying, oh, no, no, Assad is out of control. He's a maniac. He's a psychopath, and he's this is getting into be a genocide. That's the kind of a thing we're going to start seeing. At that point, they're going to say, we have done all we could, and now we are going to be united to get rid of Assad in the name of humanity. And as I said, that's when it will be open for all the troops, still with the Muslims, whether in Turkey or Jordan, taking the lead, even though the lead in this case comes from behind. And that will be a positive PR for the United States, meaning U.S. wants to look as if they are supporting the United Arab League and Turkey, of course, who are very seriously disturbed by Assad, rather than appearing as what they are, the lead in this assault on Syria, on Assad's regime. So that is the game. And with Jordan, again, they denied, but they denied with interesting words. And as I said, other media, international news organizations, they confirmed the story. They reported on this, and we haven't seen anything here. I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing. Forget the mainstream media, the so-called alternative. I mean, today I had to write a piece and say, what in the world is going on with antiwar.com? I used to be one of their major supporters. When you go to their site, you see all this news putting out these numbers. Okay, Syria, Assad's regime killed 5,000 people. Now, who is counting these bodies?
Well, we don't have a source.
Exactly.
These figures are presented without any corroboration.
And that's what sites even like Anti-War are doing. And they are putting these numbers because they usually, you know, turn their nose and say, oh, well, Boiling Frogs Post, your sources are anonymous, and therefore it's not a confirmed story. I'm saying, where in the world you're getting these numbers? In fact, a lot of these reports, they cite the Syrian Armenian, you know, army rebels, the rebels, their army, giving these statements, these numbers. Well, of course, we know where they stand. Soon they're going to say Assad killed 100,000 people. Who is there to confirm that? Now, on the other hand, reverses with Libya. Now they are putting out the numbers of civilian casualties as a result of this NATO intervention,
right,
the hawkish war there. And NATO says, oh, we refuse. We don't accept that number. Now it
let's detail it, because we said that we had to intervene and quickly to prevent massacres. And the estimate is that as many as 50,000 Libyan civilians were killed in the NATO bombings and in the crossfire between the so-called rebels and Gaddafi's forces.
Correct. And the same thing we are going to see with Syria, because right now they're throwing out all these numbers. None of them have been substantiated. But let's say we go in there, we take over. When we come out, there is going to come, and it's going to be on page B16, Peter. It's going to say that actually it was not as it was originally reported at 5,000. The real number was closer to 136. Yet the NATO troops and the coalition forces, the number of the civilian casualties is about 30,000 or 40,000. So basically, we went to a country to intervene on the death of, let's say, 200-300 people, and we ended up killing 40,000 or 50,000 civilians. As I said, it's going to appear on B16. It's not going to be what we see today, as even with alternative sites like antiwar.com, to put it in there, Syrian Assad's army massacred, you know, 182 additional. It's like, where? I go read the story. It's completely unsubstantiated. As I said, I don't like Assad. I am not Assad's fan, but you would think he will learn a few lessons after Libya.
And Iraq. And Afghanistan.
Exactly. There you go. But they're doing the same thing, and I don't see people screaming. And I am mainly really angry with the so-called alternatives, because I have given up on the mainstream media. I had given up on them long time ago. But as I said, here's a site that I'm a big fan of, and I go and I see all the war drums. The sound is like deafening on all the casualties from Syria, and not a single one has been substantiated.
Well, and Sibel, that just triggers in me a comment that one of the most common refrains that is heard in people's discussions of foreign policy in the U.S. today, and it comes from people of all stripes. It's not a partisan matter. But so many people say, we simply can't let Iran have a nuclear weapon. And that is a false premise from which false choices are then presented. And, you know, I don't want to see Iran develop a nuclear weapon. I do believe that is their long-term interest. But we have survived, you know, nations developing nuclear weapons like Pakistan and India and Israel, and the world has not come to an end. And while I consider it, you know, not a positive development if Iran does develop it, the idea that we would launch a war to prevent them from gaining a weapon that they may never use is just incredible to me. And when I hear otherwise intelligent people repeat the mumbo-jumbo that we cannot permit Iran to ever develop a nuclear weapon, well, I'm sorry. That is trash thinking. And it's not, you know, logical. It's not rational. It's not coherent. It is simply a political talking point that has been propelled into the national conversation. And there are far too many people, unfortunately, who can think critically enough to say, oh, well, that's not really true.
Right, and it's much easier to say that and preserve some pseudo-nationalism or national identity or national pride than say, we cannot give up on Iran's oil and a strategic position. Okay? I mean, think about it, because even if you were to go and put it there and with all the facts and everything, all the points presented beautifully, showing that we are there because of strategic positions and also the resources. I mean, Iran is huge. I mean, you look at Caspian Sea, it is the ultimate prize. And that's why all the activities in Central Asia and Caucasus. But to go and say, well, we must. If you don't want want to pay more than $85 per gallon, we must get Iran. We cannot give up on that oil and a strategic position. It's very difficult. So I think some of them, maybe some subconscious, they find it much more palatable, much more much easier to say, oh well, you know, they can't attach terrorism. When was the last time Iran engaged in terrorism? Really, that is provable. Name one.
Well, they've been on the receiving end of Stuxnet and targeted assassinations of their nuclear scientists.
And they still have been playing like Gandhi here because they've been turning the other cheek.
In a lot of ways, that's true.
If you look at it, what have we gotten in terms of retaliations on the terrorism they have been receiving? Really nothing. And even with the people they have detained, they have been returning them all unharmed. And even with the, when you broadcast all the 1980s footage that the media, U.S. media, loves to play and replay and replay and replay, is the hostage taking, you know, mm-hmm. with the U.S. embassy in Iran right. during the revolution. They were not killed. They were all returned. So, I mean, really, when they look at it, they really don't have any excuse on Iran. And as far as their own human rights records are concerned, you know, Saudi Arabia's, Bahrain's, Kuwait's, they dwarf Iran. Or when you look at Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan and the level of atrocity and the dictatorship there, again, they would dwarf Iran.
Mm-hmm.
So they're having a really hard time, but that has never stopped them before in making up things and putting it out there and with media publishing it day after day after day, repeatedly, it's always on the front page. It's always a bold headline. As I said, when the facts and the realities come out with Syria, it's going to be on B16. Today, they are on page one, and they are really in bold print. The numbers, that 5,000, that number 5,000, just go and look how that was advertised by the mainstream media and the alternative.
Well, Sibel, thanks for this conversation, and I know you and I both get quite a bit out of Pepe Escobar. I consider you a real treasure, and I enjoy the Boiling Frogs Post interviews that we do together. And every time we talk, I learn more from you and from the people that we talk with. So I'm looking forward to more in the coming year, and I wish we didn't have so much to talk about.
Yeah, that's one thing that you and I both 100% agree with, and unfortunately, I don't think we're going to have that opportunity anytime soon.
Sibel Edmonds.
I'm hoping that will secure it for our kids.
That's Sibel Edmonds, and Pepe Escobar joined us earlier in this interview here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Thanks for listening. Happy holidays, Kwanzaa, Christmas, whatever you like, and Happy New Year from the PBC Show.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.
Don't you want the Republicans to wake up?
With the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.